This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. For listeners of this podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook to give you a chance to try out their service. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/sword. That's audiblepodcast.com/sword.
Is part of the Frog Pants Studios Network. For more information about this and other shows, visit frogpants.com. Audio program so good, it's like you're there.
I'm Veronica Belmont.
And I'm Tom Merritt.
And this is the podcast where we talk about what science fiction and fantasy books we are reading. We go over some of the discussions over on Goodreads in our forum. And we just talk about general nincompoopery.
And we drink wine.
And we drink wine. Brandy.
Wine. Well, I was drinking brandy last week, but I'm drinking wine this week.
You're back on the wine. So what are you drinking?
I am drinking a 2005 Cosentino Winery Cabernet Sauvignon.
Cosentino is an excellent winery. I have enjoyed many of their fine vintages, and I'm happy that you enjoy it as well.
It's quite delicious, I have to say.
Good. I am drinking a 2007 D'Arenberg Diaries Original Shiraz Grenache.
Ooh, a Grenache.
Yes, a Shiraz Grenache.
That's not desserty, but it's kind of sweet, right?
It's not too sweet, actually.
Oh, really? Okay. Does it have notes of cherry and fall leaves?
Yeah. How did you know?
I don't know.
Because you clicked on the link, didn't you?
Oh, it's Australian.
Yeah, all Shiraz is Australian.
Is that right?
Yeah, Syrah is not.
I've learned. The same. I guess I should have like figured that out over time because yes. I have drinking.
As to the best of my knowledge, Syrah and Shiraz are the same grapes of different regions.
Like Cabernet is actually Bordeaux, but you can't call it Bordeaux.
Precisely. Or yeah. Champagne. It's the same right. kind of thing.
Right. Sparkling wine.
But anyway, this is not a wine podcast. We just like to talk about
not
what we're drinking
yet.
Because we think it's fun, even though some of you don't. I what are you going to do? You do enjoy it when we're slightly more intoxicated in the episodes, though. So you gotta take both sides.
We seem to see that effect amongst the people who give us feedback. I'm just saying.
We're just saying.
We're not advocating.
It's just something we've
anything.
Noticed.
Okay. We're just noting scientifically an observable effect.
The show is also best listened to a little bit drunk as well, I would say, probably.
Well, no, not necessarily.
Maybe totally trashed.
No.
For us to make sense. No?
It's a different experience.
A different experience.
And not necessarily a better one.
Are we funnier? At least.
We think we are.
Okay.
I think that's what
well,
you're trying
that's
to say.
Really all that matters. All right. Well, let's start off with the quick burns.
This is a story from the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists.
The what now?
By Laura H. Kahn. A general internist who began her career in healthcare as a registered nurse, writing about the importance of science fiction for science. She starts talking about neurophysiology and tells a lot of stories about research and brings in Frankenstein and how Frankenstein actually popularized discussion of neurophysiology and brought to the fore vivisection and anti-vivisection and cruelty to animals. And in the end, she finishes this up saying, scientists in the life sciences generally do a poor job of communicating with the public about what they do. Few of them write for the lay public, and even fewer write novels about their science. Busy scientists generally don't have the time to write fiction after writing grant proposals, not to mention the fact that writing engrossing stories is very, very hard. But if the scientific community wants to engage and inform the public, science fiction is an excellent strategy. Mm-hmm. Stories captivate people, they survive the test of time, and they become part of the popular culture. So if any scientist with a creative writing affinity want to captivate the public and inspire the next generation to pursue careers in science and technology, perhaps they should put pen to paper and start writing.
Interesting. And also without that, we would not have terms such as Frankenfoods and Frankenfish.
That's very true. Mm-hmm. I like what she's saying as far as encouraging scientists to write fiction if they have the time. I also like what she's saying in a way that she doesn't make clear, which is scientists partnering with science fiction. We've talked a couple times about a few like proto projects. I hope that becomes a thing. I hope that becomes a trend. I hope that becomes something that becomes widespread, where scientists and science fiction writers team up, because the science fiction writers don't have the training or the inclination to put in the long hours to become a scientist. Likewise, scientists don't have the room and the freedom and the time to write fiction. And so instead of, you know, hoping that everyone becomes a Renaissance person and can do all that stuff, I think it's great to say, if you can, do it. If you can't, team up.
I'm curious to know what people out in our audience think are modern day examples of this kind of phenomena happening. For example, you know, we're dealing a lot more these days with things like artificial intelligence and virtual reality and augmented reality. And are books like Snow Crash, for example, you know, any of the William Gibson books, are these affecting the way that the public is perceiving these kinds of technologies? Whenever we talk about artificial intelligence, who always comes up? Hal, right?
Yeah.
So is that some kind of effect? Is that the same effect there?
The classic examples of Arthur C. Clarke describing satellites and then satellites being made. Star Trek having communicators and then cell phones sort of mimicking that flip style later on.
Dinosaurs in Jurassic Park. I mean, we're doing that all the time now.
I'm not sure that's the best example.
Well, things haven't gone very well in that particular
that
area.
We're still waiting on.
We're working on it.
It's coming.
We have a post over by Cory Doctorow over on Boing Boing about science fiction flash fiction. From people like Neil Gaiman, Moorcock, Westerfield, Gene Wolfe, and others. I'm having kind of a hard time understanding what's happening here. I read this article and I looked at the Flash site, and I'm confused. So maybe you can explain this to me.
There's an illustration by Las Vegas artist Jeremy Zerfoss. And I think what's happening is all of these writers look at the art, mm-hmm, and then come up with a quick flash fiction story.
Like
about
an insta-fiction.
Yeah, exactly. So it's not even a short story. It's just a quick, like, this is what's happening in this picture. For instance, it's a picture of a big yellow monster and some shorter green monsters and a bunch of monsters kind of dancing around in a big happy sun. And Lev Grossman says, "This appears to be a happy sun, the kind that an innocent child might draw amid fluffy white clouds in a bright blue sky. Do not be fooled. This is not a happy sun, and it does not wish you well. The solar Medusa is a floating translucent gas bag that cleverly interposes itself between you and the real sun," and goes on for there to mm-hmm finish out the paragraph, but it's a nice short little story.
I'm trying to find the Neil Gaiman one and I can't find it. I've clicked on like all the little things and it's not, I can't find where it is. It's just crazy.
Another example of science fiction.
Oh, I found a Patrick Rothfuss.
Oh, nice.
Okay, so here we have the Antherian Bloob. "Despite the fact that we are living in the midst of an age of reason, the Antherian Bloob remains something of a mystery to those who study natural philosophy. Rare and reclusive by nature, no bloob has ever been taken captive for a scientific study. Thus, the scant information we possess is anecdotal at best. At worst, it is nothing more than the wild speculation of armchair biologists." And it goes on to describe this creature that we are seeing in this picture. It's not, I haven't read the whole thing that he wrote here, but it's pretty funny so far.
Neil Gaiman wrote The Shatter.
And where is he? Which one is he?
He's like the big yellow guy.
Oh, the big yellow? I clicked on that. I'm not getting him. I'm getting Kirsten Kasai.
Where are you? You can click Critters Listed by Author.
Oh, that's more helpful.
Yeah.
Where is that?
Down on the bottom right.
Oh, technology is hard. Oh, there it is. All right. Well, this is very cool. It's cool to kind of explore and find the little stories that are built in there. It's very cute.
Gene Wolfe has one in here.
Yeah, too. I mentioned him.
Who else? Oh, you did? I missed it when you mentioned him. But yeah, there's about, I don't know, 20, 25 mm-hmm. authors here. So
what a great idea. Check it out. Fun idea.
Wofford.edu/sharedworlds, or we'll have the link in the show notes at swordandlaser.com.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and hey, we've got some new Game of Thrones pictures for season 2. And oh yeah. My God, Sir Davos looks amazing. I love him.
The World of Ice and Fire, a companion book to the Song of Ice and Fire novels, will have its release date announced in the near future. It is a companion volume co-written by George R. R. Martin and the admins of the Westeros.org website, featuring new artwork, never before seen maps, as well as lots of other background information.
Heck yeah. I want that.
Oh, I'm getting that.
I want that thing. That is awesome.
Ooh. And yeah, there's a bunch of other pictures of the cast, like Brienne, mm-hmm. Gwendolyn Christie, looks fantastic.
Yeah, they uglied her up pretty good.
Looks the part.
They uglied her up. And also, you can also purchase George R. R. Martin's A Game of Thrones, A Feast of Ice and Fire, the official cooking companion, which is a
real
thing.
We'll get to more of George's recipes later in the show. Finally, IO9's Maria Konnikova has a post titled "What Frank Herbert's Dune Can Teach Us About the Power of Positive Thinking," and it's essentially about the psychological underpinnings. We were just talking about science and science fiction, the psychological underpinnings of Muad'Dib and Jessica and all of the characters in Dune, and how their reactions and their analysis of their own reactions are rooted, whether intentionally or not, in solid stress-related psychology research.
Interesting. That's really cool. I mean, it's. I wonder how much Frank Herbert looked into this kind of stuff or thought about this kind of stuff while he was writing it.
The article originally appeared at Scientific American's Literally Psyched blog, if you want to find it there as well. But she talks about how studies have been done with stress and the fact that you don't perform as well on things when you're stressed unless you have habits built up. Mm-hmm. And that's essentially what Dune is talking about. Jessica talks about how Paul Atreides holds up under stress well because of his training. Mm-hmm. And he decides to pick a positive path. And basically, Konnikova says that totally is borne out. If you build up habits of reaction when you're stressed out, you will follow those habits of reaction, and you can choose to put a positive or a negative spin on those reactions.
I like her last two paragraphs. She says, humans are remarkably adaptable. Paul quickly learns to appreciate the positive aspects of his new surroundings, to enjoy the quiet and value the beauty of the new landscape, but he could just as easily have shut down, spiraling into a negative feedback loop and losing his cool entirely. And as you mentioned also, in fact, had he not had prior mental training to deal with just such stressful contingencies, he would have likely done so. Certainly, he would not have been in a position to learn a new positive coping mechanism in the heat of the moment. Maria, she says, I take Jessica's words as a timely reminder of the need to train yourself mentally for emotionally charged moments. It's easy to forget how quickly our minds grasp onto familiar pathways when given little time to think or when otherwise pressured. But it's up to us to determine what those pathways will be.
So it's more than just fear is the mind killer, people. Mm-hmm. Okay,
it's our own innate training and our inability or ability to cope with stress and outside forces.
Right. It's also that fear is the little death.
I don't think that's what that means.
No, that's the line from Herbert. I know there's another little death that you're thinking about. That's not the one Herbert's talking about this time.
Let's go to the calendar. All right, on February 14th, which is probably when you are listening to this show, hopefully, Valentine's Day, we have...
Happy Valentine's Day!
Ari Marmel has Thief's Covenant, A Wittershin's Adventure, which we've talked about before, and Anne Rice is coming out with The Wolf Gift, which is her new werewolf story. She's moving on to werewolves.
Oh, yeah. Next week, February 21st, A Perfect Blood by Kim Harrison is out. Ritually murdered corpses are appearing across Cincinnati.
Oh, goodness.
That's Cincinnati.
Cincinnati. Yeah.
Terrifying amalgams of humans and other. Ooh. Pulled in to help investigate by the IS and the FIB, former witch-turned-daywalking demon Rachel Morgan soon realizes a horrifying truth. A human hate group is trying to create its own demons to destroy all Inderlanders, and to do so, it needs her blood.
Uh-oh. And then on February 28th, which is the last short day in February, we have Singularity, the Star Carrier series number 3 by Ian Douglas. Here is an unseen power in the universe, a terrible force that was dominating the galaxy tens of thousands of years before the warlike Shadar were even aware of the existence of Sol and its planets. As humankind approaches a singularity, when transcendence will be achieved through technology, contact will be made.
Oh, singularity.
Mm-hmm.
February 28th isn't the last day in February this year.
It's what? What are you talking about?
There, it's leap year.
It is?
Yeah. We have a 29th.
We have a 29th?
We do.
I don't know if that's on my calendar. Does that
all those people with 29th birthdays can actually celebrate their birthday on the right day?
That's so nice for them.
Yeah. And then St. David's Day, the patron saint of Wales, March 1st. Timeless, the Parasol Protector at number 5 by Gail Carriger.
Yay!
Alexia Terabody, Lady Macon, have settled into domestic bliss.
Macon,
of course,
Lady
being
Macon.
Alexia, such bliss involves integrating werewolves into London high society, living in a vampire's second best closet, and coping with a precocious toddler who's prone to turning supernatural relief.
Oh, you spoiled it.
I didn't spoil it. The description from Publishers Weekly spoiled it.
Spoiler. Hate myself.
It's just what you would read on Amazon.
Take that off the website. Take it off. off the website.
I didn't do it.
All right. Well, we'll pick up on more calendar items later.
Oh! Yeah. That gets you through March, so. The rest of them are at swordandlaser.com/calendar.
All right.
Including the spoilers.
Well, this podcast is brought to you by audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many of the New York Times bestsellers. For listeners of this podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook to give you a chance to try out their service. And as we have mentioned before, one audiobook to consider is The Coldest War by Ian Tregellis, who is one of our favorite authors. And
I am listening to it right now.
Are you loving it?
It's not coming out in print until July 17th. Please, do not wait.
Oh, I'm so excited.
You don't know what you're missing. It's so good.
I don't know what to do because I'm getting really close to finishing 1Q84 now.
Uh-huh.
It's stuff is happening.
You're doing it by audiobook. Right?
I'm doing it by audiobook. Yeah. And so I've got that. I'm working on the second or third Gail Carriger book. And
which I just ruined, but okay.
Thanks a lot. And I really want to read The Coldest War, so I've got a lot of listening to do still. So many audiobooks.
The Coldest War is so good. It's so well read on the audiobook. It really comes alive and picks up. A lot of times when I read these books that are in a series so long after I read the original, mm-hmm. I kind of forget who people are. These characters come back like that. And it's so well done. That feeling that you got in Bitter Seeds, if you read Bitter Seeds, of, wow, this is World War II, but it's different, is I can't believe how well Ian Tregillis was able to replicate that with Cold War, with 1963 Cold War. I feel like, yes, this is the Cold War, except different and still consistent with Bitter Seeds. Anyway, I can't say enough. You could get it for free if you're not already an Audible subscriber at audiblepodcast.com/sword. That's audiblepodcast.com/sword. Get it even if you are already an Audible subscriber and pass that URL along to anybody who isn't.
We should try to get Ian back on the show again.
Yes, so I can just be a total fanboy and tell him how awesome his book is.
How much we love his books. Yeah, we'll probably do that at some point. All right, well, now it is time for Barrier Sword, which is our feedback from the audience. Now, we had a great thread that was started by our friend Alden O'Neill, and he says, reading Vance's posts, books you love but were hesitant to recommend, I found a lot of recommended now that I now want to read. That got me wondering, and I can't believe this hasn't been done on Sword and Laser before, but if I can't see it, it doesn't exist.
You're the first, Alden.
What's the one sci-fi fantasy book or series you would recommend above all others? I'm looking for one title, no fudging. If you fudge, you'd best justify the hell out of your response. JK, LOL. But seriously, pick one. He says his is Red Mars.
Good choice. Interesting choice.
Interesting choice.
Lots of fudging going on in the responses, but still some great responses. In fact, I'm almost tempted to say we should pick our next book out of this thread.
Really?
Somehow.
Because there is also a thread going on right now where people are pretty insistent that we read on See, this is going to be a problem. This is why I can't
pick
this
book,
because
that.
I can't say that word.
On Basilisk Station.
Basilisk.
See, I've always wanted to read The Belgariad by David Eddings, which was Tassie Dave's pick for recommendations. I was surprised that these were not the obvious recommendations I would have thought. There was one person who said Lord of the Rings and a few people who were like, no, not Lord of the Rings. but that's the kind of thing I would have expected, like, you know, some safe popular choices like that. The new Sun series, well, actually the whole solar cycle from Gene Wolfe was suggested. Perdido Street Station, I thought, was an interesting suggestion. Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy is probably the one where I'm like, yeah, I think that's what I would go with. Although, as one person pointed out, it depends on the person you're recommending to.
Well, that's what the whole point of this thread is, which is it doesn't matter.
If you don't know the person you're recommending, what's your default choice? I guess I don't know if it would be Hitchhikers, actually. I might recommend Dune then.
There were a few Dunes on this list. Yeah, Ryan on the list recommended The Dragonbone Share by Tad Williams, which was one of my first fantasy books. So maybe that would be a good one. That's a good starter. It's a good any fantasy book, but I think it's good for people who are just getting into the genre or discovering it for the first time.
I take it back. No fudging. Hitchhiker's Guide. How can you not like Hitchhiker's Guide? I mean, I know there are some people who don't, but...
I don't know. Are there people who don't?
No matter what you recommend, there's going to be someone who doesn't like it. So I think that is probably the widest appealing...
Tassie Dave recommended The Belgariad by David Eddings.
I just mentioned that. Now we're even.
Oh, you said his.
Yeah, I did.
Well, I heard you say David Eddings, but I didn't hear you say it was Tassie Dave.
Oh, maybe I didn't attribute.
Okay.
My apologies.
That's
Tassie.
Okay. I think that's a good one too.
Tassie Dave's other post.
That's a pretty good one. Wow. Yeah. Perdido Street Station. I don't know, Bree. I heard you say that one, Tom. Don't worry. I'm just saying. I'm going through the list right now, as you can probably hear. It was Josh who recommended.
It wasn't Josh who recommended the Solar Cycle. Okay.
It was Ed. Josh has jumped in. He says the 13 Clocks was his unqualified recommendation.
Interesting.
I want to see that. I want to read that. That sounds pretty good.
I want to see those words.
I want to see those words in my head. What? I do. I can't tell the difference between reading, seeing, or listening.
Good job, Alden O'Neill.
And then we have one from Glenn, which is science fantasy versus science fiction. And he says, can I just say that I hate the term science fantasy? I think it's stupid and ignorant for anyone to say that grandiose science fiction is in some way not science fiction, but instead is science fantasy. I know that there's not much of a real difference between the term fiction and fantasy, but there is to me. Fantasy to me means that it's completely impossible. It's something that you have to imagine because there is no basis in reality for it, i.e. magic, multi-gods, etc. Well, that's debatable for some people. Fiction, specifically science fiction, is something that may be possible with our current understanding of science, but could be true given changes in our understandings of physics. Things like multiple dimensions, faster-than-light travel, neutrinos, shields, etc. are all examples of things that right now don't exist, but have been demonstrated feasible or theoretically possible. So he goes on... he asks, what do others think? Can people tell me what they consider science fiction versus science fantasy? Book examples, for example? I said book examples, for example. He didn't say that in his post. So a couple of books or series to classify. Anne McCaffrey's Dragon Riders of Pern, Hamilton's The Void series, Hamilton's Night's Dawn series, Herbert's Dune, Di Prima's A Galaxy Unknown series, and Star Wars. Who's got others, and what do you think?
I know what he's talking about specifically. In fact, one person in the thread pointed out, like, I can't do this anymore. I've seen it on so many science fiction and fantasy boards because people are using it to bash these old fashioned sprawling space operas and say, those aren't science fiction, they're science fantasy. And I agree with them that that's wrong. Those are science fiction. Just because you don't like the style doesn't make them not science fiction. Mm-hmm. But I believe that there is something called science fantasy that is perfectly fine. There's nothing wrong with it. In fact, 1Q84 to me is somewhat science fantasy. where it's got enough science in it to be plausible, but it doesn't stick to it. And in fact, I was thinking about this. I'm like, you know, Patrick Rothfuss is somewhat science fantasy.
Okay, wait
because
a second.
He's very academic, and he's got a scientific method to the magic. But in the end, he's not trying to pretend that this can all be explained through current science that humans know. It's a separate fantastical science that he has created.
I need to call you out for a second because while I am not done the book, I really would like some clarification on what you think is at all based in science in 1Q84.
Well, the fact that there is alternate universe that, you know, from quantum mechanics that could be possible that you would have an alternate universe. There's not much, you know.
I'll give you the alternate universe theory.
That's pretty, it's pretty loose. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, there's gravity. People don't float away. I don't know. They're trains.
Mm-hmm.
Policemen have guns. Yeah, there's not much. So that may be the lesser of my two examples. But
mm-hmm.
Blindsight, I think, is hard sci-fi because of the amount of physics in it. But I know a lot of people feel that's science fantasy because of the vampire.
Mm-hmm. Allah says, I'll just say this. Star Wars isn't science anything. It's pure fantasy.
You know, that's a really good point. And some people got their hackles up about that. They're like, no, Star Wars is sci-fi. I'm like, no, it's not really. It's actually a good example of science fantasy because there are ships and space and there's some, you know, talk of sciencey terms like parsecs, but it's got the Force. Mm-hmm. And there is, until Phantom Menace anyway, no attempt to explain the Force through science.
Mm-hmm.
The Force is a mystical, you know, quasi-religious thing. So to me, that's pure fantasy.
Well, I mean, they've got the, what are they called? Midichlorians.
Yeah, I know. That kind of sucked. I was like, well, now you've ruined it. It's just biomedicine.
Midichlorians?
Yeah, the midichlorians are still just a kind of a substrate for the Force to imbue someone with its power. So I still feel like even though that to me kind of weakened the concept a little, mm-hmm. it was still a concept of fantasy, not of science.
I also just heard the sound of thousands of screaming Star Wars fans all crying out in anguish at the same time at my pronunciation.
And then falling suddenly silent.
And then suddenly falling silent.
Because Veronica came in her Death Star and blew them all away.
Because guess what? I like Star Trek better. So,
oh, you did not just
I did that. Wow. That just happened.
All right.
I've seen all the Star Wars movies. I've seen them all. I'm just
Alex
not, like,
pointed
a huge
out Star
Wars
Trek
fan.
Is sci-fi and Star Wars is space fantasy because Star Trek really tries very hard. Not that it doesn't have some fantastical elements.
It's just our future that hasn't happened yet, Tom.
But it tries very hard to explain everything it does through science, especially in the later series,
mm-hmm.
Like Next Generation, Deep Space Nine. Well, Deep Space Nine has the whole Bajoran weirdness. that gets a little fancy.
I guess, sorry. Anyway, let's talk about Abraham Lincoln vampire.
You want to talk about TV movies?
I would like to talk about TV movies and video games.
All right, let's do that.
So the trailer for Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter, which is one of the best books that I read in the past couple of years, in my opinion. One of my favorite books.
It looks like it's going to be one of the best movies, too.
I hope so.
Did you like it?
I enjoyed the trailer. There are some things in there that I don't remember from the book.
Okay.
Like a burning train scene. I don't remember that.
Yeah, it's Hollywood. You got to put a burning train scene in.
I understand. It looks a little more, and this is going to sound ridiculous, a little bit more comic booky than I was expecting.
Well, one thing I'm glad about is they didn't try to go realistic.
I kind of was hoping they would because, in my mind, it's a historical fiction.
And that's kind of the comic book thing you're talking about. But he has got the full-on suit and the stovepipe hat and the beard while he is slaying.
Yeah.
And that's what I want.
But that's not what happens in the book, really.
What?
That's not really what happens in the book. I mean, most of the book is him, growing up and discovering who he is and what he's turning into and...
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to spoil it too much, but it's kind of his origin story. He's Buffy.
Yeah.
And I hope the movie is similar to that. And not just all of him just being president. But I'm it's, you know,
what that suck if it was like an hour and a half of a really dry documentary of Abraham Lincoln's actual presidency. And then it's like the last 20 minutes it becomes a Vampire Slayer.
But yeah, as you said, Tim Burton is producing it. And that's exciting. I think that's going to be pretty cool. I'm not too familiar with Timur Bekmambetov. Bekmambetov? Who is the director
Easy
of the
for
film.
You to say.
No, apparently not. but I'm excited about it. I have a feeling it's going to be pretty brutal. I have a feeling it's going to be a lot like another Tim Burton film. What's the one with the barber? No, not the barber, with the pies and the
The pies?
Yeah, the pies.
Pushing Daisies?
They bake the people into the pies and come on, Tom, help me out.
Sweeney Todd?
Sweeney Todd.
Oh yeah.
With the pies, right?
Yeah. I was in that play in high school.
Were you?
Yeah.
Were you Sweeney Todd?
I was.
Were you?
Yeah.
Can you sing some Sweeney Todd for us?
No, it was a drama. It wasn't a musical.
Oh. It is a musical though, right?
No, yeah. There is also a musical, Sweeney Todd.
Well, can you sing some of the Sweeney Todd for us?
No, because I didn't wasn't
can
in the musical.
Can you say
in
some of the Sweeney Todd for us?
I don't remember any.
I was in the musical of Peter Pan, and I had one line, and it was, look, a cake, a cake.
I was one of the two Chinese guys in a musical of my freshman year in high school. Anything Goes.
Oh, Anything Goes.
Yeah. And I had a line like, look, a cake. That was my only line.
It's the typical line. We were in a vampire-related thing together.
We both were.
I don't know if most of our listeners know this.
That's true. We were in Vampire Secrets mm-hmm. on the History Channel. Mm-hmm. And I played a 16th century doctor who goes to investigate a woman who turns out later to be a vampire, along with Josh Lawrence, who is my assistant.
Yes.
And Veronica is killed by a vampire.
I was a virgin that was sacrificed to Madame Bathory. So it was a big stretch for me.
Well, the Bathory part? I don't know.
No, it was super fun. It comes out every year on the History Channel. They play it during Halloween.
Around October. Check it out. We're not credited.
No.
But every year when it comes out, I know because I get a couple Twitters like, I think I just saw you on the History Channel.
Were you a doctor in a vampire show?
Yes.
No
yes,
one ever recognizes me because I have a sack over my head.
Yeah, and your hair is all tied back too. So yeah.
Yeah, that was part of the problem. I had to wear like a big headband thing because I had my ears pierced. My plugs were in, and so I had to cover them because no one had punk rock plugs in their ears when they were, you know. Whatever.
Hey, to that handful of people out there who hate it when we talk about Game of Thrones, just fast forward like a minute. Real quickly, producer Vince Gerardis did an interview where he talks about the Battle of Blackwater. Originally, the report was that the Battle of Blackwater would last 16 minutes in the penultimate episode of season 2. Turns out that was a mistranslation of the Portuguese interview. But he did say that it is a sizable portion of the episode and is, quote, fantastic. But still being produced with a TV budget.
It should be the whole episode. The whole episode.
No, that's too much.
No, I mean, it isn't the most. It is like the most epic battle in the whole series, I would say.
I know, but you need a little lead up, not the entire episode.
Well, lead up in the episode before it.
I say 30 minutes.
All right. Well, there's also a post that George R. R. Martin is reading nursery rhymes.
Have you listened to this?
I haven't listened to it yet.
I wasn't sure if this was old. It's also from the Wart Zone, and he just posted it. It's celebrity story time. So you've got to just go read it. Either go to thewordzone.blogspot.com or goldenswordandlaser.com and click on the link. George R. R. Martin starts off with, you know, your normal.
I'll play it at the end of the show.
Yeah. Excellent. We'll put it at the end of the show. But you got to watch him read it too because you got to see his expressions as he turns like Little Miss Muffet sat on a tuffet eating her curds and whey and thin leek soup. And then he just keeps going on about all the different things that she has to eat. It's all classic George R. R. Martin stuff. He twists like three different Mother Goose rhymes into fun Westeros-oriented themes.
Nice. So we have already gone really long in this show. The show is already 50 minutes and we haven't even touched upon our book wrap up yet. So
I am only 33 minutes.
Really? I've got 50 minutes. I must have started recording before you.
I think so.
Okay. Well, then we have approximately 20 minutes to talk about Rule 34. So yeah, spoilers. If you have not finished Rule 34 at this point, now is probably the time to stop listening.
Yes.
Because we are going to talk about the book in its entirety.
And we know a few of you haven't finished yet. Mm-hmm. You're struggling to get through. You're working through that early part because you're not into the crime thing, and we understand. So just bookmark, come back when you're finished. And no harm, no foul. We understand.
So yeah, why don't you give me your opinion, Tom? How did you enjoy the book or not enjoy it?
So as I mentioned, last week, it took me a while to get in. I was not immediately in love with the mystery, with the crime. I was not immediately in love with the world. It just struck me as another sort of postmodern, cyberpunkish, let's show some shocking scenes to shock you with the shockiness. And I was not excited about it. When it turned for me is when it first started to describe the fabs as your crime situation, and this idea of how the fabs became the new pirated music of the modern age. I really got into the surveilled state and how everything was surveilled, but this wasn't a panopticon where, you know, the police therefore controlled everything. The police job was still really hard, and I think that was very realistic. I think Charlie Strauss nailed it about, you know, here's what changes when everybody can be viewed and here's what doesn't. I'm 50-50 on his predictions of the financial situation and how that plays out, and how states become the kind of the bad actors because banks and businesses are so regulated. But I think it's perfectly reasonable. And I do love the idea of countries acting like corporations and outsourcing their debts and their problems to revolutionary countries temporarily to get rid of them. I think that was pretty brilliant. And frankly, the toy maker and Anwar were the two characters who ended up sucking me in. And I said, okay, Anwar is more than I thought at first. He's not just kind of a shallow bad guy. He's got more going on in his head. He's got some talents. Mm-hmm. He's not unbelievable. And the toy maker was not just kind of your classic noir villain. He was a psycho.
Crazy.
As soon as that became apparent and I was like, oh, his like business acumen is all in his mind. He's crazy. I was like, this is much more interesting. I love it.
The lizards. The lizards and their rape machines.
I mean, haven't you thought about the lizards?
Who hasn't thought about the lizards and their rape machines?
Well, rape machines, not so much with me.
Just lizards?
Just the lizards, yeah.
So I feel much the same way that you do. I originally was really enjoying Liz and really enjoying the crime aspect of the novel. It started off pretty strong with me. I cracked up when she got on her Segway to travel to the crime scene.
And that was pretty funny.
I really enjoyed some of the world that had been built up. I like how you have to bid on where your bus travels.
Yeah, that was pretty innovative too. I like that too.
I liked thinking about cop space and the way that they use it. I liked thinking also about how I can see myself living in this kind of world. Like I can see the progression of our technology into this, you know, slightly futurized version of the technology we are currently using. It seemed very believable to me in many ways. I thought the kickbacks to some of the memes that we've experienced in recent years to be very clever and fun, maybe a little too heavy-handed.
Well, yeah, but when you put it next to now I'm blanking.
Which one?
What's the video game book?
Oh, Ready Player One?
If you put it next to Ready Player One, Ready Player One was just meme-tastic, you know, like keep them coming. They're falling out of the sky. More 80s video game type memes, but still. So I felt like this was much more judicious than that.
I thought it was fun thinking about like things like the Streisand effect, which is something I haven't thought about in a really long time, which was a pretty classic meme. Liz kind of dropped off for me, you know, the same way she kind of did for you, it seems, when Anwar and the toy maker came into the equation. I didn't like Anwar at first, and that was around the time when the book started getting sloggy, was when it was mostly Liz and Anwar.
Yeah, same with me.
And I was like, okay, this, you know, the jumping back and forth between the second person narrative between these two is confusing. I'm having a hard time following along. And then the first Toymaker chapter, I was finally like, okay, this is interesting. Because he also, not all of his chapters were first person. I'm not even sure if most of her
were second person, you mean?
I'm sorry, second person. Yeah. I think the narrative switched sometimes for him or for some of the characters. And I found that to be kind of refreshing to kind of jump back between these different narrative styles.
I got really used to the second person after.
Oh, I got used to it for sure.
First three or four chapters. And so I stopped paying attention. You may be right. I know that there was Liz's friend who was in town was the perspective for a couple of the Toymakers chapters.
What do you mean?
In other words, when she had the date with the Toymaker, you had a chapter that was told from her point of view instead of the Toymakers.
Yeah, well, there were a couple of chapters with when she had the point of view.
And I liked that storyline. I thought that was good. In fact, I liked Liz a little better once that storyline got going because I felt like it was less about her suffering through the ranks of police. That just didn't interest me as much as her relationships and when she actually got to work on an actual crime and it wasn't just kvetching about how she's stuck in the dead-end job and she could show some skills. I liked that better.
Yeah. Oh, was her name Dorothy? Was it Dorothy?
Oh, right. Yeah. Friends of Dorothy, of course.
Yeah. So, yeah, she had some pretty good chapters. I found the rape scene to be very disturbing.
Yeah, it was. And that is always a split benefit, or not a split benefit, but a split analysis of, well, if it's disturbing, it's obviously written well. And it has
why
purpose.
Would a rape scene not be disturbing?
It wasn't gratuitous. It had a purpose. It was meant to be there to show the total psychotic nature of the Toymaker from the outside. But it was hard to read. I agree.
So I always wonder how much of what was going on in the Toymaker's head was real and what was his own fabrication.
Right. I think you're meant to wonder. I think that's true because when you see him from Dorothy's perspective, you see a whole different person. And it's a very cold, calculating and absolutely psychopathic person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was probably the most interesting character, I would think, for me. And maybe he was supposed to be in a lot of ways. But I felt like the book, I mean, I know it's a series, but it wrapped up very strangely for me. I felt like as soon as I really understood what was going on, as soon as I was starting to get some answers, it just like, snap, done, over.
That's interesting. You know, I finished, the context of my finishing it, I was on an airplane. And I was trying to time it out so that I wouldn't get interrupted right before the end. You know, I hate that when you're listening to an audiobook and you're interrupted 5 minutes before the end. So I actually went to double speed and was really concentrating and enjoying it and like kind of watching the clock a little bit. And that may have kept me from being disappointed by the end. I was like, oh yeah, okay, great. Yes, this is the way it ends. Perfect. Done.
Because as soon as we really got into the whole Athena side of things, like I really wanted to dig into that more and learn more about what was going on. And that was really only in the last 10%.
Yeah.
I'm sure it's because he's saving it for the next book.
Although he says it's a loose sequel to his previous book. And so, yeah, maybe Athena's going to be a prominent main character in the next book. And it won't involve Liz or Anwar or anybody else.
Yeah. So then it leads into the whole discussion of artificial intelligence and what does artificial intelligence mean and how does it kind of go off on its own? Because it seems on a simplistic level that the AI in this scenario, Athena, is kind of taking matters into her, you know, to personify it in her own hands.
And really well written as an other character where you can follow the logic but not the motivation of why she's doing what she's doing. And really felt like, wow, if computers started to do stuff, they might do it like this. And it's not, it's a moral evaluation in an entirely different way than humans make moral evaluations. It really reminded me of Daniel Suarez and Demon.
Oh, absolutely. Point. Yeah, that's actually a really, really good comparison. I wish I'd thought of that. Good job, Tom.
Well, now you did.
Now I did.
Wait, what?
But it was especially interesting because these aren't just like, you could see an AI murdering people by doing things like, you know, shorting out their virtual reality headgear, or, you know, doing something in cop space that, like, you know, damages their brain or their retinas or something. I don't know. But the way that she was doing it was so interesting. Like, causing these coincidences almost, yeah, and tying together, like, basically making assumptions on how the people in the book or how the people in her world were going to react.
All based on probabilities, right?
Right. And I thought that was really cool. And you know, it took me a while to kind of, you know, start thinking about that while I was reading.
It reminds me a little bit of Gretel from Bitter Seeds. Who she was the, if you haven't read Bitter Seeds, slight spoiler alert, but she was the German who was able to see into the future.
Mm-hmm. And see what decisions people were going to make.
And so she does a lot of long-term thinking herself.
Right. You don't know what the immediate outcome of her decisions will be, but she's always got a plan in place.
Yeah.
No, that's very, very Athena-like. That's true.
Except without the emotion, right?
Mm-hmm.
Without
they both don't. I wouldn't say.
Well,
that
Gretel's got emotion, but it's not compassion. Whereas Athena's just devoid of emotion.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's compelling enough for me to want to read the next book, though.
I want to see what the next book's about, because I at first I would have said no, but having enjoyed the last half so much, if it sounds like the story is going a place that involves the things I liked about Rule 34, then yeah, I'll probably read it again. What is worth reading is Charlie Strauss's about page, thanks to Nick on Goodreads for pointing it out, at antipope.org/Charlie/blog-static. We got the link in the show notes, but he wrote an about page about himself, which is absolutely hilarious.
What did you like about it?
It's just he wrote it in the third person, and then talks about how writers talk about themselves in the third person a lot. He goes through his entire history of writing and the mistakes he made going to pharmacology school and becoming a pharmacist and then getting held up in drugstores a bunch. And so he decided that he didn't want to be a pharmacist anymore. So he went back to school and became a Unix admin, did technical writing. And it's just really well written and entertaining.
Very cool. It didn't surprise me how many people in the Goodreads group did not enjoy this book. It did. Well, it did and it didn't.
I think a lot of people couldn't get past that first third.
Yeah. And that was a tough first third. I will admit, I thought for a while there that I was going to have to pull a Stanislaw Lem.
Wow. You're going to lem it, huh?
I was considering lemming it. Because
that's harsh.
So for our new listeners, to lem a book is for...
In Veronica's world.
In Veronica's world is for one of us, often myself, deciding, often without telling Tom, that she is no longer going to continue reading the book that has been
picked.
We
shouldn't have read Memoirs Found in a Bathtub. Those of you who love Stanislaw Lem, I picked the wrong book for Veronica to introduce her to Stanislaw Lem. It's my own fault.
Well, you know, it happens sometimes. I have lemmed it twice with
What's
Memoirs.
The other one?
The Moon is a Harsh Mistress.
Oh. I'd forgotten that.
I didn't admit that at the time either.
Yeah.
I got about 70% of the way through, and I was just like, nope, not going to keep
reading
it. I missed
Avalon, did.
Did you?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, you admitted that. That's when I admitted The Moon is a Harsh Mistress to you, and you admitted Mists of Avalon. I can't believe you didn't finish that book. Because you love Arthurian legend.
I know.
You love the shit out of it.
It was really long.
It is very long. But anyway, we are like totally digressing. I did not lem it. I powered through, and I'm glad I did. Because I would recommend this book to people who... I would recommend this almost to the anti-Ready Player One fans.
Yeah. Actually, I would. I'd say if you really disliked the light, crunchy, snacky nature of Ready Player One, and you want to sink your teeth into something that involves the internet and its memes, check Rule 34.
There you go. So we've given you the antidote.
There you go.
All right. Well, I'm going to continue reading everyone's feedback for this book in the Goodreads forums. We didn't include any of the discussions this week just because we were already running so long on content. Maybe we'll do a little Goodreads Google Hangout at some point where we can get some of the readers together and we can talk about why we did or did not like the book. I think it'd be fun to get more of a group discussion going on that.
And we did a lot of our own analysis this time as well. So So thank you for your sufferance in allowing us to do that.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, let's touch on some quick emails. Are you done discussing? You feel complete?
Yeah. I'm enjoying reading three books now. So I know we're going to pick another official pick next time.
Mm-hmm. I still have to read Empire State.
I'm reading Empire State. I'm reading Blue Remembered Earth, and I'm reading The Coldest War.
I am reading. I'm still on 1Q84. I just finished Rule 34, so I've got that to go still. I'm reading. I want to start Empire State next, but I have to finish Silent in the Grave first, which is our vaginal fantasy pick. Not for us, for the other book club I do. You know, the other book club that I'm cheating on you with.
Because you just had to start up a second book club because one was not enough.
I didn't start it.
You joined it.
Anyway, so emails. We have an email from Michael, who writes, "Love the podcasts. So the idea started with one of the guys calling the other girly man." I like how this email starts.
Okay.
"So to keep a fight from starting, I gave a quick class on how all males are 50% female due to the X chromosome. I have seen shows where a person goes through hormone replacement therapy as part of their gender change and are shocked by the changes in their personality. Has there ever been a book where someone grew a man with two Y chromosomes, a free male, so to say? If not, I'm sure that it would be a good idea for some book. Part of it sounds like something China or North Korea would do to make a super soldier. If nothing else, maybe they could just be put in charge of the House of Representatives." That's an inside joke for you, Tom, apparently.
Okay.
"Signing off from Afghanistan, SSG Michael Mugler."
Thanks, Staff Sergeant Mugler or Mugler.
Mugler.
And thank you for your service. I don't know about the two Y chromosomes. I'm not saying it's never been done or never been written about. I also don't know if you could make an argument for surviving with two Y chromosomes.
I need to know the science of this now. I mean, I know the basic science of it, but I want to know more of the science. I want to know if that would actually work or not work. I'm sure we have listeners in the audience who could tell us. So you should do that if you have any idea.
XYY syndrome.
Are you Googling things?
What? Yeah. I just looked it up on Wikipedia.
What's that?
"A human male receives an extra Y chromosome, giving a total of 47 instead of 46.
And then what happens?
It's a clinical phenotype. And it's normal.
Yeah.
They have an increased growth velocity from early childhood with an average final height approximately 7 centimeters above expected final height.
Well, there you go. It's a terrible book idea because it's a real thing.
No, that's no real things. That's the whole science fiction.
I'm just joking. I'm just teasing him. All right, our next email comes from Brandon. He writes, "Hi, Tom and Veronica. I heard you talking about the Bain Free Library on the last episode and wanted to mention that for years, Bain included CDs with some of their hardback books that included ebook versions not only of that book, but other Bain books. I always thought it was a great way to encourage fans to try other authors as well as additional books in the series, and Bain encouraged people to share the CDs with friends."
Wow.
That is awesome. Am I saying it right? Bain?
I always say Bain.
Bain. "A fan has put together an archive of all the CDs online, and we'll give you the link in the show notes. For those of us who own the Bain hardbacks, it's an easy way to get all the CDs content in one place. Since the CDs were distributed freely, it appears to be a completely legal way to get a number of free books from Bain that are not available for free in their store. Not sure if this is show worthy material, since I've not heard if Bain has commented on the website. It is totally, yeah. There you go. It's on here. It has been mentioned on Penny Arcade before. Regardless, I highly recommend Bain, as they are a company who seems to understand the benefits of digital distribution and to treat their customers much better than most publishers with reasonably priced ebooks, combo packs, and free books." Brandon. Cool.
Thanks, Brandon. Good stuff. I had no idea that they had an archive of CDs online. That's cool.
Well, they don't, but fans have put together an archive.
Well, that it exists.
That it exists. It does indeed.
Shall we do some new member hellos?
I think we shall. Hello to Scott.
Manuel.
Brad.
Aubrey.
Eric.
Jeannie.
Ryan.
Chris.
Bob.
Shane.
Nick.
Stan.
Susan.
Barry.
Jess.
Paul.
Thomas.
Ted.
Robin.
Teria.
Mira.
Mason.
And Stuart.
You cleverly gave the hard to pronounce ones to me.
I planned it that way.
Teria said, "You pronounce my name as if you're a snobby Englishman saying terrier." So I hope I got
Teria.
It right.
Teria.
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 Teria. Mm. That's how I... Teria.
She got herself a tire.
Natalia ate that rat over there. He fished it out from that hole in the wall.
Downton Abbey, go to some Italian.
Natalia. We don't actually say your name like that. I'm sorry.
No, we promise. We're saying terrier.
Yes, we are. If you want to email us, the email address is feedback@swordandlaser.com. The website, as always, is swordandlaser.com. You can follow all of our discussions over on Goodreads. And if you want to call, leave us a little voicemail number, voicemail message, I mean. The phone number is 415-779-6735. We love hearing from you guys. And we will see you guys next time. And we will also have a book pick on the next show.
We will. We promise.
So wrap up Rule 34 and get ready for the next one.
Rathalisk.
Rathalisk, maybe. If I ever learn how to say it. Bye.
Jack and Jill went up the hill to fetch a pail of water. Jack fell down and shattered his legs, which made him easy prey for outlaws. His screams echoed through the war-ravaged valley. The wolves and ravens feasted on his body for days. Baa, baa, black sheep, have you any wool? No, sir, no, sir, I have no wool. I shall take no wife, hold no lands, father no children. I shall wear no crowns and win no glory. I shall die at my post. Little Miss Muffet sat on her tuffet eating her curds and whey, and honeyed lemon cakes, thin leek soup followed by a salad of green beans, onions, mounds of mashed turnips, jellied calf's brains, a thick venison barley stew, snails in honey and pigeon pie, and a leche of stringy beef. Along came a spider who sat down beside her and shot her through the bowels with a crossbow.